KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Good evening, I'm Chris Mattis in San Francisco. As Roy Moore continues to hemorrhage support from potential fellow Republican colleagues,
Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball Show, is in town, and he'll join us in studio to talk about a new biography he did of Bobby Kennedy, as well as the Republican tax plan and the Roy Moore sexual misconduct scandal.
And the fact that he might be going to he wouldn't be banned from the U.S. Senate, but he'd be banned from this shopping mall.
Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Chris Matthews, longtime host of MSNBC's Hardball, is known for his political analysis and combative style, and he joins us in studio this hour to talk about the Republican tax bill, the latest developments in the Russia investigation, the Roy Moore scandal, and his new book on Bobby Kennedy. And we'll also explore how politics and the media have changed since the Kennedy era. And good to have you back with us, Chris Matthews.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, let's begin with some news stories. Now we've got talk about repeal of the insurance mandate with the tax bill. It seems like a kind of Hail Mary, but it would appear, at least at this point, that they're turning the debate maybe to health care or maybe trying to get something through at the end of the year when nothing has gotten through this Republican Congress. So what do you think's going on here?
Well, there's a lot of bad blood from the Republican side just generally, and I think this would be kind of an undermining, to put it lightly, of Obamacare, of affordable care, because if you take away the modest incentive to enroll by healthy young people, you make it more expensive, obviously, in a pool of insured risk. You make it more expensive for the people with health challenges who are older, who have pre-existing conditions. And so this is going to be a real incentive to pull out of the system for people who are young and healthy. And as that occurs, it drives up the prices of those who stay enrolled and forces more of the young and healthy to pull out. And so you end up not really with an insurance plan, but with a health maintenance plan for people who desperately need health care regularly. It's a disaster. And they know they're doing it, and they say they're doing it to save $300 plus billion over 10 years so that they can finance their tax cuts for the wealthy. It's pretty direct.
Does it make it easier for them to get a tax bill through? I mean,
apparently, in the caucus of the Republican senators, there are several members who truly are budget hawks or deficit hawks who this will appeal to. They'll say this is a way of fixing the scorecard so that it will look like we're adhering to this $1.5 trillion cut over 10 years.
And getting rid of the dreaded Obamacare. Right?
And in these rural states where those people are fiscal hawks, it sticks a knife into Obamacare. I mean, it's hard to tell these stories without sounding partisan, but they're pretty clearly a shift in wealth and in pain, and pain toward the thing in the tax bill which grabbed me was so emblematic. If you can afford, and I went to parochial school, I understand there's not everybody who goes to private school is wealthy. We had tuition of about $300 a year, $400 a year if you had 300. I think it was $350 if there's two sons. So we weren't wealthy, these were parochial schools, but they were private, though. But under this new tax plan, you can now write off all prep school tuition. But you can no longer write off interest payment on college loans. So the working kid who's struggling, maybe three or four kids in the family, or just doesn't have much money at home, who's struggling through college and picking up debt at 8%, now we'll be told you can't write off that 8%. But the wealthy parent of the prep school, including the boarding school, student, the Choate kid, the one at St. Paul's, total write-off of the tuition. If they get away with that, that's pretty much a shot at the Trump voter, I think.
But how are they selling this?
They're hiding it.
It's a Christmas gift to the middle class.
They're hiding it.
you could just conceal to what extent, though. I mean, the fact of the matter is all this is sort of oozing out as old-style supply-side economics.
Yeah. It is really, I think you nailed it, Michael, because if the one benefit, beneficiary is the person who's invested in the stock market to some extent, 401k or big time, because they're basically pouring, by cutting the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20, they're pouring an enormous amount of money into the cash holdings of these corporations. This goes right to cash. And what I'm told is they're already already are cash heavy, that they don't need it. This just money that's going to go to the stockholders, which is going to keep the Dow going up, give Trump still bragging rights. He loves the Dow, and without benefiting anybody real out there who voted for him.
We keep hearing about how the stock market is continuing to move up under Trump, and there's a kind of almost celebrating of all that among the GOP. But they haven't gotten any legislation through, and it looks like they probably aren't going to get any legislation through.
Well, they get this probably.
You think they will get this?
I just looked at Goldman Sachs' prediction on this morning. They got an 80% chance of getting something through.
Something.
Yeah, I think they might get – they always go for the skinny at the end, Michael. You know, that's what they do. They fail, then they throw something skinny out there. But I think their idea of skinny is something fat for the corporations.
You think they're going to maybe get something through in the way of another special counsel like has been floated by Sessions and company?
You know – I really do want to root for Jeff because I think there's a part of him that has some pride. I think he's holding out. I think yesterday he was just doing a slow walk, you know, a little passive aggression there, telling, well, I've turned it over to the experts and they'll decide whether. And of course, no prosecutor is going to say we can't handle this case if there is a case. I'm wondering where the body of the crime is.
Uranium is what they're saying.
The decision on uranium was all over the table. It was done by four or five departments. It was all signed, duly signed. Hillary apparently, well, you never know about the Clintons. I'm not here to sell them because you never know what they did. But apparently they had nothing to do with the action, although she's clearly the officer in charge. But then you get to this question. I do think this is tricky and perhaps worthy of investigation. This huge amount of money contributed by this Uranium One company and its associate corporations over in Russia to the Clinton Foundation. And did they think they had to sweeten the deal, even if she never got to write the signature on the agreement to allow them to buy that company? I don't know. It's a stretch, but I can see that if the left had this in their pocket, they might be pushing for a prosecutor, too.
Well, it's almost as if Jeff Sessions, despite your empathy for him, is really trying to toe the line or do something that his president would like him to do. And I thought the same thing was true, and we may disagree on this, with General Kelly. I thought he was trying to do what his commander-in-chief wanted him to do, particularly in light of what Federico Wilson had brought to light. I mean, he essentially came out and said something that was completely different than what the video said.
Yeah, I think, well, they're all employed by the president, basically, and they serve at the pleasure of, really. And I think they're trying to maintain their post-Trump credibility.
Tom Friedman says there's only one with credibility left, and that's Mattis.
Yeah, well, that's a stern statement, but not a bad one. They're all tainted because, Saturday Night Live, more than anyone, exposes them to their absurdity. And I only say that because I thought that he didn't go down completely with him yesterday in the hearings. He seemed like he was trying to show that, look, I may do this, I may not do this, but I'll now say I'm thinking about doing this in a way of keeping Trump at bay because he thinks he's going to get fired by Trump. But maybe they'll reach an agreement and how Trump will say, why don't you go back and run for Senate again and I'll back you.
But Trump is still furious about the recusal. But if he does back Jeff Sessions, it would be in lieu of presumably Roy Moore. Actually, Trump backed Lucas Strange. Lucas Strange, there's an idea there.
Well, the trouble is down there in Alabama, they have their own ideas and they keep voting for this guy and they may vote for him again. But the problem they have is, I was just thinking this through this morning, if Trump decides to pull the plug today, like Sean Hannity looks like he's going to do, of all people, they all pull the plug on Moore. They say, we're not going to endorse him anymore. And if they do convince Judge Sessions Jeff Sessions to go back and run himself, you've got a three-way vote down there where Doug Jones, the Democrat, probably wins. So they lose the seat for 3 years. They'll get it back eventually. There's no way a Democrat with a Democratic voting record can survive in Alabama. I mean, they'll expose themselves rather quickly. So, but they can lose the seat for 3 years.
You know, this all brings up really your book in my mind, because the division we find now, not only politically, even within each party, you know, you got the Bernie faction and the Democratic Party and the Hillary faction, perhaps, or something along those lines. You've got the Tea Party people and the Bannon people sort of at odds in many ways with President Trump. But the reality is, you see Bobby Kennedy as someone who really brought unity, particularly between working class and people of color. And
he tried.
He tried. But, you know, in many ways, he had that image. And it's a very poignant one that you come to in your book, those kids saluting, for example, as a train went by, and all of those working class people who revered him.
Michael, look at the back of the book, and when I wrote a piece for the San Francisco Examiner magazine years ago, that I guess it was the 25th anniversary of his death. Somebody in the art department dug up that picture. It's almost a 3D picture on the back in glowing color. It's the sun's going down, and there's a family, very poor family of white people. The father looking like a working guy. He has a crisp, almost naval or army salute he learned in the military, you can tell. His skinny, dirty kid's got no shirt on. It's dirt all over him. He's saluting, obviously, at his father's request. In the back, you see this other dirt poor family member, the wife. And they're showing a kind of affectionate patriotism for Bobby Kennedy. That gut patriotism and the Democratic left have sort of they've gone different ways. And I think the party's gotten a bit too sophisticated on issues of social importance, but they've left them behind. And the other part is the black community in Baltimore. When you recall the fact that 20,000 African-American people spontaneously sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and they knew all the words and they sang them. I assume they learned it at church because it's a religious hymn as well. That they weren't in the same crowd. The whites and blacks weren't hanging around together singing the same songs. But there was a unity of purpose, a belief that the overlooked people would be given their attention if Bobby won, that he would actually care about them. Jack Neufeld, one of my heroes, the great columnist for the New York newspapers, said that Bobby thought that cops and waitresses and firefighters were his people. So he never went away and discarded them. He kept the white working class as he embraced minorities. And I think that's something that's very difficult to do, and he was really trying to do it.
And, you know, it's ironic in some ways because he came from such wealth, but people say similar things who are Trump supporters. You know, he appeals to us, he understands
us. But he divides.
Of course he divides. But
Bobby didn't do that. I think, you know, it's fairly easy, and I don't want to be too nonpartisan because I'm not, but if you say I'm going to take 40% against the 60, Trump shows how easy it is to do. You simply start with a foundation of racists. You go and say, I don't believe this president of ours, Barack Obama, is legal, that he somehow assumed an identity. No one knew him in school. That's spooky ways to say that. No one knew him in school like he was a Manchurian candidate. He wasn't even legitimately a person. He was some phantom. Then he snuck into the country from Indonesia or Kenya. That got you your foundation of racist right there. And then he went further with the Mexican thing, the wall.
The judge and the wall.
The judge and the wall. Yeah. And then he got the people who didn't like Hispanics, the large numbers of people living here. And then he went after everybody, the Muslim crowd, and he went after them because they're Muslim. And all the time he's building up to his 30-some percent with basically division. Now, that's not hard to do. And if you're on the left and you're raising money in the Democratic Party, just to be crass about it, you can go the other way and always take the different position. But you can have an open borders position on immigration. You can take a lot of positions that are divisive in themselves. But the hardest thing in the world to do is to try to bring those communities which are not, they don't fit well together socially for whatever, well, we know 400 years of reason for that, to get them to agree politically. And I think Reagan pulled away with the Reagan Democrats in 1980, and then Trump went all the way with them. And where I grew up, I have cousins. I've got several brothers who are part of that. We don't even talk at Thanksgiving. We're not going to talk at Thanksgiving. What we do is we just laugh and enjoy the turkey because there's no reason. He has worked very successfully to divide the country. But it's not hard.
You and I grew up together.
What's so hard about being a racist? I mean, it's easy to be a racist. You just appeal to white fears and the old prejudice of neighborhood disputes and just race. It's a pretty easy thing to do.
But it was always there as an underbelly, always there under the rocks. I mean, where did the division that we see now? I mean, sometimes I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's a little bit of sentimentality in Matthews. There's a kind of nostalgia, you know, and the Gipper and all that kind of stuff, crossing the aisles, and now Bobby Kennedy, we were unified under him and so forth. Maybe it was always there. It just had to take despotism or some kind of catalyst to bring it out,
Michael,
from under the rocks.
Let me just tell you. I used to work for 3 years for a great man, Edmund Muskie of Maine. You all know him. Everybody knew him. They thought he had a bad temper, but he was a fantastic legislator. And every year on the Senate Budget Committee, which I was on, I worked as a staffer for it, we produced a budget. He and Henry Bellman from Oklahoma, the same budget. They worked it out. Each segment of the budget, they worked out a fiscal policy. They agreed on it with an almost unanimous vote in the committee. They really tried to work together and figure out things in debate. and in negotiation how we should run the government. And so I did see it happen. I did see Tip cut deals with Reagan over Social Security, and it was like delivering the baby in a ransom case. It was very tricky. It had to be choreographed by Jack Lew, who later became Secretary of the Treasury. These things had to be done elegantly. They were closely run, but they did achieve success. We had a tax bill that cut the total rate, the top rate, to 28%. We dealt with an immigration policy, which was a good policy. It was actually a comprehensive bill, you know, Simpson-Mazzoli, but, you know, it was never enforced, thanks to Pete Wilson and people like that and the farm owners. But, you know, it does work. It does work. Even Mitch McConnell's a deal maker. I mean, look at him. I mean, he's dumping this guy, Roy Moore, like a bad habit. I mean, he's a survivor, this guy.
But the unity.
But I do believe in it, because if you don't have that hope that we can get along racial, across racial lines, then where are we going? You got to believe in it.
You also believe in Bobby Kennedy, though, and he certainly went through a kind of conversion, because he used to associate himself with Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohen and people of that ilk. And
well, he never liked Roy Cohen. He loved McCarthy, though.
Trump liked Roy Cohen. He was a mentor to Roy Cohen. In fact, Roy Cohen was a mentor.
Birds of a feather.
But, you know, a lot of this, it's interesting. You get into some of the familial stuff. You know, Bobby Kennedy was the shortest, and he was the maybe most neglected and the youngest and all. And it's kind of a psychoanalytic study in some ways of what made him passionate and what kind of character he really had. What I was always struck by, though, was in terms of Bobby Kennedy, first drawn to somebody like Joe McCarthy, that was a kind of, and this is the world you know, there's a kind of a reactionary Irish Catholicism that came out of serious doctrinaire ideas. And then there was also the eleemosynary side of that, the charitable side, the giving side of that, the generosity side. It was almost as if a lot of his Catholic upbringing shifted, did a seismic shift.
Give me a minute, because this is really important to the soul of this book. Bobby grew up like I did, an older boy, black and white. You know, there was the white milk bottle and the black milk bottle. When you're going to hell, when you're going to heaven. Everything was simple. But he also, even during that time, he came out against Father Feeney, who taught no salvation outside the church. This is as a kid at Harvard. He said he hated that. He wrote an article for the Boston Advertiser, appealed to the church, to the cardinal. You can't have a priest out there saying that the Catholic religion says that if you're not in our religion, you're going to hell. So he really was breaking loose back then. He also did things like insisted Ralph Bunche, the Nobel Prize laureate, speak at his lecture series down at UVA Law School. Fought all the Southern white kids over that. Went to the president. So there was intimations early on. On the theological side, he went from being sort of an Orthodox or regular Catholic to a Dorothy Day kind of Catholic. He went to the Catholic Worker. He went to the social ministry, to the social welfare. He would sat down near the end with Robert Coles, the Harvard psychologist, trying to figure out who he was, and trying to figure out why. He would say, what makes Cesar Chavez get up in the morning and pursue this social ambition of helping his people, the fellow Mexican-Americans in most cases, the farm workers who were treated like slaves? What moved him in the morning? What moved Dorothy Day in the morning? How did their religion energize their social work, the good work they did? He was trying to figure that out. He was into Michael Harrington and the Other America.
Leader of the Socialist Party in the United States.
Yeah, he was Holy
Cross. But he also, the big change was after going and meeting the Freedom Riders and doing this.
Yeah,
the
I think that was the personal stuff. The John Sigenthaler moment, where John Lewis, who was a kid then, and Harry Belafonte, who I really relied on in this book, they saw in him his soul starting to move. He began to move because he had skin in the game, because Sigenthaler, his top aide, went down there and had his head bashed in with a lead pipe and was left to lay on the street for a half hour by the police. He realized the hatred that they were up against in the Deep South when he was trying to open up those schools like Ole Miss and Tuscaloosa and Alabama. He realized that they hated blacks, and they would hate anybody who helped them. And I think he grew. I mean, I think the great thing about Bobby is, whatever your politics, it's nice to know that a public figure can actually get better over time, learn more, accept more, whether it's learning McCarthy's abuses, or it was learning how the civil rights really matters in a human way to African-Americans. It took them a while to get beyond the intellectual and the political, to get us to the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he had to fight his own instincts of Geronimo. We're going in. We're going to blow them up. Wait a minute. Do we kill people by the thousands out of, you know, a strategic purpose like that? Do we just start killing people? He said that's what was done to us at Pearl Harbor. And he won the round. I mean, I think he does grow. I see it.
Well, I wonder, though, thinking about a line from Ethan Kane in a novelist I know, people don't change, they just reveal themselves. I always stuck in my head.
Well,
for
that's
some
not
reason.
A bad argument. I think that's true here because I think Bobby as a kid.
Bobby was ruthless, though. I mean, there's
oh,
no
yeah,
denying
for his brother,
that.
For his brother.
Well, not only for his brother. I know somebody, I'm not going to mention by name, but who worked with him, who and a person I admire very much, who said he was a real SOB. I know he was nice to people who were, you know, like on the street, and he could be, he'd identify with victims and everything else. But some of the people he worked with said, you know, he was Machiavellian, and he was almost
the epitome. Well, yeah, it's all true. You can be tough for good. Yeah. And maybe the liberals have to learn they can be tough for good. You know, the bad. I wrote a book called Hardball to teach the good people how to play by the rules of the bad guys, because guys were born with rules.
Any of those good people can step up here to the Democratic leadership that you know of?
I'm waiting like you are.
We're talking to Chris Matthews and talking about Bobby Kennedy, talking about politics, and really interested in what's on your mind, especially want to hear from those of you who have memories of Bobby Kennedy. A little bit of hagiography maybe here, you think?
I think I've got a lot in there about the Kennedys and their dealings with the Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, and the mob.
I'm talking about Bobby,
The mob. Yeah, right. Bobby looks like the good guy most of the time.
Well, Bobby went after the mob. I mean, in fact, he did a shift there too, didn't he?
He had a problem. His father was getting money from Sam Giancana in West Virginia. His brother was having an affair with Giancana's girlfriend, and the CIA was using Giancana to kill Castro. Meanwhile, he's leading this crusade against him, using the IRS and Mort Kaplan, his old professor at UVA, to catch all of them, put them all in prison. Yeah.
I remember reading The Enemy.
There was a conflict there.
I'm dating myself here, but reading The Enemy Within and thought, wow. You know, I mean, that was the only response I had as a kid.
Did you like Frank Kierdorf, the arsonist?
Yeah.
The guy who burns himself to a crisp, and this, I guess, fellow Catholic or religious guy comes up to him as he's lying in the bed ready to die, and he says, "You're about to meet your maker. Why don't you come clean?" And the guy goes, "F you." You know, it's just, these guys were tough.
Yeah, they don't make them like that anymore. Let's get you, our listeners, involved in this conversation. We do want to hear from you, and you can join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, your thoughts about Bobby Kennedy, but also about, we haven't even touched the ongoing Russian investigation. Chris has strong sentiments about that, as he does about Trump and so many things that are in our political news. But you can join us with your own, and we do welcome your questions or comments. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, and join us that way. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and we welcome your comments and questions on our Facebook page as well. Please feel free to join the program now. I can also add the fact that Chris Matthews has a book out about Bobby Kennedy, and it's called, and the title says a great deal, A Raging Spirit. He also is the host of MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews. And you ought to listen to Hardball if you want to hear some rather strong Hardball thoughts about Donald Trump. I know there are many listeners who like those kind of sentiments, but please feel free to join us. We'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
That's from Bobby Kennedy's 1966 Day of Affirmation address to students at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Certainly an extraordinary speech, but I'm looking at a comment from a listener named Brian who says, "Is Bobby's speech from the night Martin Luther King Jr. was killed the greatest speech in history?" I don't know how you evaluate that, but former speechwriter
sure,
Chris Matthews. That was an extraordinary moment, to be sure.
Well, first of all, give credit to Adam Walensky and the others who worked on the Day of Affirmation speech. I think I wrote in the book it was his greatest speech because it was written down. It was all prepared and worked on and worked on and had majesty to it, because instead of going in there with moral superiority to the white community of South Africa who had invited him, the kids from Wits, Witwatersrand University, who are all liberals, He basically went in and said, he talked about a country that had been founded by the French Huguenots, and then they were beaten by the Dutch, and then the Dutch were taken over by the Brits, and how the English-speaking people never really found a way to deal with the Aboriginal population. And so you thought he was talking about South Africa, and he said, I'm talking about the United States. And what he was really saying was, although we may be a little further along on race, we've come from the same place, and we're no better than you are. And it was in a wonderfully humble way to begin the conversation down there with those people. It was a fantastic success. The speech he gave in Indianapolis was of a totally different order. He had just come from – he had spoken that day on April 4th, 68, at Notre Dame. He had spoken at Ball State. In fact, an African-American had challenged him on his hopefulness, and he had said, I think that most black people and most white people are pretty good people, and, I think we're going to make it. But he gets into the car, and he's being driven to the airport. He finds that King has been shot and killed by a white guy, a racist, obviously. And he says, I can't believe I just told that kid I was so hopeful. I feel so stupid. So he gets there. The police, it's a black neighborhood, a tough neighborhood, I guess. The police refuse to escort him in. He goes in alone. He gets up on the platform, up on this flatbed. And I got it from the NBC tape. He said to the guy next to him, do they know yet? And the guy says, no. He has to tell this exuberant crowd, cheering to see him, that the greatest man in their history is dead and killed by a white guy for racist reasons. I think there are a lot of that speech is redundant. It lacks elegance, but what it has is an honesty and a vulnerability you cannot deny.
Well, because he spoke of his brother's death.
Yeah, yeah. Because he went in and said he took his skin off. Basically, he walked in and said, "Okay, here I am, a white guy, the crowd that just killed your greatest hero. I'm one of them, but I'm also one of the people on this earth that has had suffering, that has had a brother killed." And he inelegantly said, killed by a white man. But it was his awkward way of saying, I'm here unguarded, unarmored, to try to find understanding. I thought the best part of his speeches was the line where he said, we have to make an effort. Because that's all you can do is make an effort. Politically or personally, when you deal with people of different backgrounds, you have to make an effort to cross barriers. And he was saying, and then he said at the end, and let's say a prayer for our country and our people. Say a prayer. He's one of the few politicians, when he said prayer, he meant it. It wasn't one of these phony, our prayers are with the victims, this phony thing these politicians do today.
Our thoughts and our prayers.
It's so secular and so phony. It's like the stuff that goes on at lunches when they evoke the Lord at lunch at some Rotary Club. He meant it. He meant it. He said he believed in it, in prayer. And this is a family that sat around and prayed the rosary every night. I mean, the Catholic religion is not always looking good in history by far. We do have the Inquisition and a lot of other problems. But Bobby's Catholicism was real, and it was charitable.
Dolores Huerta was on this program fairly recently and said the same thing, that he was really a committed Catholic and remained a committed Catholic. And you could see that he was trying to pretty much subscribe to some extent and to a great extent in many instances to what theology had taught him. Looking at a tweet here, though, some pushback from a listener who writes, ask him how he can continue to label the Kennedys as moral people when he knows damn well they had little respect for women or the virtue of marriage.
Well, I thought about that, and I certainly was open in the book about Bobby's attempt to protect his brother from exposure that way. That he never went to Jack, who was really something of, I wouldn't say a predator, but definitely promiscuous beyond imagination even. That he never told him, stop doing that, Jack. I guess he accepted the fact that's what his brother was, whatever you call it, addiction, whatever you call it today. But he clearly tried to protect him politically from it. As for his own personal life, I really, to be honest with you, never got into it because I didn't think it affected the public man in this case. I also thought I wanted to know about Bobby Kennedy as he is to us today, as he was to us then. The private part of his life, I never thought was something I wanted to get into, so I didn't get into it. I don't get into assassinations in my books. I always think that's another story. That's the story of the assassin. It's, you have nothing to do with your own assassination. I mean, that's part of your life you have no control over, really. And I didn't really want to, I wanted to tell the story of this public man. And I understand people would love to do a Marilyn Monroe piece and all that, but I thought I told enough. And I wrote the book I wanted to write. We really don't know about Marilyn Monroe.
It remains an enigma. By the way, there's so many theories about that.
And my feeling is somebody will bring it out. It's not going to be me. Somebody else is probably better at it than that stuff, the scum kind of writing.
I don't write scum, actually.
I'm not big on it.
Bring up a caller here. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think that until the left and the right become completely honest about their analysis of our politicians and our candidates, that we're not going to move forward. In other words, I want to tie it to Bobby Kennedy and JFK. I think Bobby Kennedy was a much better candidate than JFK. I think JFK was a great president, but he had his private predilections, which were very, they were bad. And so I think that Mr. Matthews is not being fair when he analyzes and goes after Trump, because, you know, Trump had his dalliances as well, but they weren't to the level, or rose to the level of JFK. So I think he's being unfair and disingenuous, and that's not to say I'm a Trump supporter, but we have to be fair on both sides. Otherwise, people are going to continue to be frustrated.
Chris Matthews.
Well, I think I've focused on the public life of Donald Trump, his public statements, his public positions. I don't really know his private life.
Well, a number of women have come forward, and why everybody in Hollywood gets heat from women coming forward, but Trump doesn't.
Well, that's not what your caller is saying. Your caller is saying I've been too tough on Trump in that regard.
I don't understand.
I think there's enough in the public square to debate.
Well, there's also the argument that presidents somehow become Teflonized when it comes to
this. I took a lot of heat back, and the caller doesn't know this, maybe you forgot it, but I took a lot of heat for being tough on Bill Clinton and Monica, the way he covered for that and used his cabinet. I was very upset and said so publicly when he went into that Roosevelt room in the White House with people like Dianne Feinstein standing there and basically used all them to claim I did not have sexual relations with that woman. He used his public role to protect himself in his private life. I was very tough on that, that he was not just saying, just shutting up and saying, I'm not going to talk about my private life. He used all those cabinet members to stand up for him. I thought that was wrong, and I said so. And he ended up getting involved with perjury. I was pretty tough on that. I think I've been, like nobody's perfect, but I've been tough on both sides on that. I've never really focused on Trump's social behavior, his sex life. I don't think I even talk about it.
Well, let me ask you about
something. But I do have problems with his presidency because I really think he's defined decency downward. I think calling people names because of their physical being, making fun of people's what they look like, That is the worst thing we were taught not to do as kids. Parents teach their kids, don't make fun of somebody's appearance. Don't make fun of someone's stature. This is what you're taught, certainly their ethnicity. And you're taught that from the beginning of your life in this country. And here we have a president who emblemizes the absolute opposite of it. And I've gone after that. And I've gone after him on birtherism from day one. And I know the guy. I've dealt with him for 20 years. I went to his wedding. I know him. And I've trashed him on this front. Publicly. And I... I've not been holding back.
Go to something that you did get some heat on more recently. On Twitter, a comment you tweeted October 19th, the day White House Chief of Staff John Kelly lashed out at Representative Frederica Wilson, which I alluded to before. Let me read the tweet. You wrote, quote, General Kelly acted presidential today. He acted like a leader and a father. Maybe he should give Trump some lessons. Now, the heat is from you onto Trump, but a lot of people took exception with you saying those things about General Kelly.
You know, I thought he began by he showed some dignity, then he shifted off and went on the offense, and he was wrong. He shifted his ground. He started off by showing some dignity there, and then he went off, and I can't even remember the details, but he was wrong.
Here's a listener says,
by the way, these tweetings occur in a dynamic setting. He will say something well, and I'll say something good about him. That's what I do. I call the strikes and balls.
But you're not up 6 in the morning tweeting, are you?
No, I'm not. I tweet because I'm supposed to tweet. My MSNBC insists that I tweet.
A listener wants to know, do you know who took that photo that you referred to at RFK's funeral? My dad, Paul Fusco, or Fusco. And by the way, he's alive. He lives in Marin County and has a show of his RFK story opening in March at the San Francisco MoMA.
Let's all go. I'm all for that. I think it's the most beautiful picture in American politics in many ways that I've ever seen because it shows regard, it shows affection, patriotic affection in a way that, I think the pictures taken from inside that train the day that he was carried to Arlington is an amazing statement about him. That this picture.
Do you even know how many people were lined up there?
It was maybe a million. There was numbers in Philadelphia and Baltimore, 20,000 here. I mean, It may not have been a million, but all along the tracks. And the thing about tracks, I was in India with my wife last year, and it's true in this country too. The right-of-way, it's got to be the cheapest real estate there is. It's where poor people live, right up close to the tracks, black and white. And therefore, the people of walking distance who came to the train tracks, several of them were killed, actually. They got hit by the train coming from the other direction. They were crowding up against the tracks to become into. They actually lifted the coffin up onto a platform so people could see it in the car. The car is, by the way, protected somewhere in North Philly right now. Maybe it'll be part of a museum someday. But it was just poverty coming right up to the face of and the eyes of people with position in this country. All the people on that train had position. You know, cabinet members, friends of the Kennedys, looking out at the people who have no position. It was not like that terrible beauty of the day Jack Kennedy was put in the grave, where the beautiful, the riderless horses and the De Gaulle and Haile Selassie and all the beautiful everything, Washington was crisp and beautiful. It was Yeatsian. It was, oh my God, this.
I hear you say terrible beauty, of course.
And it was like, it was something, it was almost like something good was happening, something grand about our country. Whereas Bobby's loss was just a loss. It was just a subtraction. And everybody felt it on that gloomy day. We're losing something and we're gaining nothing.
A lot of people want to know if you think he would have made a great president, a good president. What kind of president?
The war would have been half as bad. I think the war...
the Vietnam War.
I mean, look, I'm not here to bash Nixon again, but in 69, when he and Kissinger went in, they could have cut the deal they cut in early 73. They could have cut that deal. You're leaving. We're leaving. That's all that the enemy wanted us to, get out of the country. And we were willing to do that. Well, why didn't we do it in 69? All we got back were the POWs, which we could have gotten back, I'm sure, back in 69. We were in a stronger position in 69, but I think that would have been better. I do think the divisions, and you and I covered them, starting in the 60s, late 60s, when it turned bitter in 69, 70, 72, there was a division in this country that became cultural, it became generational, and then it went right into Watergate, and out of Watergate came this real divide. The Republicans got embittered because they thought the Democrats rolled up the score against Nixon, and it just continued right through Reagan, and that that division did begin in Vietnam. It began. The neocons, all that stuff, they were the division within the Democratic Party on foreign policy. A lot of that began then with the people who stuck with the war against those who wanted to end the war.
A lot of people want to talk to you. Let me get to as many as I can. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. Chris, I want to refer to Robert Caro's fourth volume. I think it's called Transition of Power or something like that.
Passage to Power. Passage of Power, yeah.
Yeah, Passage of Power. And he makes refers quite a bit to how the Kennedy clan or the White House staff, what have you, and I think pretty much led by Bobby Kennedy, trashed Lyndon Johnson, Uncle Cornpone and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I just, it seemed to me to be extremely cruel. I wonder if that's what your research turned up, and do you refer to it in your book?
Certainly, the division between the two of them. In fact, I owe Robert Caro for picking up an amazing bit of history. That bitter strife between the two of those people, Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, began in 1940 when Lyndon Johnson was sitting with Roosevelt, when Roosevelt was on the phone with his ambassador to Britain, Joseph Kennedy, sort of being nice to him because he wanted him to endorse him for the 40 re-election, the third term, which was so controversial. And so, come on home, Joe, bring Rose, we're having dinner tonight, this will be great. And meanwhile, he does an aside to LBJ, I'm going to fire the SOB. And apparently Johnson dined out on that little experience for decades, and Bobby heard about it.
Didn't Johnson also say that Joe was a pro-Nazi?
This all comes later. Yeah. Oh, this never ended. And then by the time Bobby first meets Johnson in the cafeteria of the Senate when he's working for McCarthy, Joe McCarthy, he wouldn't even shake Johnson's hand. And Johnson went over to George Reedy, his press guy, and said, it's about 1940. He knew that he had sinned against the Kennedys. But you're right. You're right, Michael. In 1960 in Los Angeles, Johnson's people and then Johnson himself were out there saying, you know, he's his father's son. The same thing they did against Jack back in 52, blame the old man's sins on the kid. And saying he was a Chamberlain umbrella guy who thought Hitler was great. This is the kind of stuff coming out of Johnson's mouth just days before he's named vice president. It's an astounding Well, it's a crisis between the two brothers, Jack and Bobby.
Well, there are those who say that Joe Kennedy was a sympathizer.
It's all true. It's all true, Michael. It's horribly true. In the book, I say he's talking to von Dirksen, the German ambassador, and he says, you know, you people, your real problem isn't persecuting the Jewish people. It's the PR of it. You're making too big a deal about it. This is Kennedy talking to a guy saying that the genocide, which was coming, was a public relations problem. Kennedy was awful, the old man. I'm not sure he was thoroughly American. The kids were patriots. They all went into war. Joe Jr. There's a terrible scene at the end where Joe Jr. is risking his life on this hopeless mission, dropping bombs over the V-2 rocket sites on the continent of Europe in France. And the old man writes this last letter to his son saying, I've now figured out, Joe, why you've stayed in Europe, because the worst billet in Europe is easier than anything in the Pacific. In other words, he was gold-breaking. I mean, it's a horrible thing to say to the son. Like, we're in cahoots. You're as much of a cheater as I am. And then young Joe trying to prove himself to the old man after his younger brother had been such a hero in the South Pacific. These kids, whatever you say about the Kennedys, they were patriotic as hell, and certainly Bobby going off and becoming an enlisted man, a swabby in the Navy. They all wanted to serve their country, and I believe, and this is pure, wonderful speculation, they wanted to make up for their Nazi father, their Nazi pro-Nazi father. They really felt horribly embarrassed by this guy's position historically. How could you defend it?
Let me get another caller on. Neil, that's you. Good morning.
Yes. I was wondering if you'd ever at least consider reading Legacy of Secrecy by Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman, which features a very critical analysis of Robert Kennedy's assassination. There was a lot more to that than met the eye.
What did you see?
Well, organized crime very probably had a hand in killing President Kennedy, and for that reason...
Very probably? How do you know that it's very probably? How do you know that?
Very critical. How's that?
How do you know very probably?
Well, this is from their earlier book.
No, but how do you know it?
Oh, Robert Kennedy thought so.
No, how do you know that the crime syndicates had something to do with killing Kennedy in Dallas, Jack Kennedy? How do you know that?
There was a good deal of evidence to that effect.
Give me the evidence.
The House Subcommittee on Assassinations reached that same conclusion, and so did several other investigative writers, for instance, Jonathan Quitney of the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, well, I don't have much faith in that House Committee. Let me tell you, sir, that Lee Harvey Oswald, from all the evidence that Bobby had in hand, and he said he had all the archival material, everything that Teddy Kennedy had right before he died, they were convinced it was Lee Harvey Oswald. So, I mean, they had some doubt because of the antipathy of organized crime, the fact that Bobby had spent so much of his public life going after people like Jan Kahn and arrested them. They always had in the back of their head some notion that maybe something had triggered something, but they think it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Let me thank Neil for the call, and here's a history professor who writes, researching RFK's first speech as Attorney General at the University of Georgia in 1961. Yeah. It appears to be closely linked with RFK's effort to recruit African-American law school graduates to work at the Department of Justice. I'm interested in hearing any thoughts Mr. Matthews has about the speech or his early step in RFK's civil rights actions.
2 points. That was a wonderful speech because he was giving notice in the spring of 61 that he was going to enforce the law. He was not anti-Southern. There was an anti-Southern white guy or even anti-Southern people. But he wanted to let them know that as Attorney General, he was going to enforce the law against segregation, just like he would enforce the law against organized crime. He was dead serious about it. This was part of his job, and he was going to carry it out. So that was sort of an antiseptic way of warning them down there. Look, I got a new job. It's to enforce the law. We're going to enforce these court orders, just like we did in Little Rock in 57. Now, he went around the hall. He used to hang out with Ed Guthman, a great guy. He was a later editor of the L.A. Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer at one point. Ed Guthman and he were walking around the hall, and Bobby, at the end of one of their daily sort of tours of the building, of the Justice Department building, is there any black people here, any African-Americans in this building? So he did a little study and found out there were really none, just custodial jobs. So he wrote a letter, Bobby did, as Attorney General, to all the top law schools. And he said, look, I'm not saying I'm going to get preferential treatment, but I want everyone who's African-American to know that you are welcome to apply for a job at the Justice Department. You know, I want you to apply. And this was the first step. He was really trying to be a good guy on that front and the right guy for that time.
Here's Pat. Pat, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. Mr. Matthews, I was in a long time Hardball watcher until the last year. And the reason being, and I would like to know your thoughts on why you did this during the primaries, on a number of occasions, you went from your live broadcast to Donald Trump speaking live at some august body like the West Palm Beach Kiwanis Club. I never remember you doing so with Martin O'Malley or, quite frankly, anyone else who was running. And you gave him millions of dollars worth of free publicity.
Okay, let's have Chris Matthews respond.
Well, I don't think my viewers watched with any kind of absorption. I think they didn't vote for – I would just bet that my viewers didn't vote for Donald Trump. That's my bet. So I don't think I got him any votes. Every night we'd make that jump. First of all, we covered everyone knows how thrilled I was by the campaign of Barack Obama. I thought he was the hot new person to cover when he ran in 08. I thought that was worthy of coverage. In fact, when he gave that wonderful speech in Boston, you were looking at the first African-American president. I thought he was making history. When Trump came along against those other people, first of all, he wasn't running against Martin O'Malley. Hillary Clinton was running against Martin O'Malley, and Hillary Clinton deserved more attention. I gave Trump attention every night based upon what we thought was newsworthy. But we would sit there, we would go into him live because he would give his speeches when we were on live. And we had to judge every night what was newsworthy. We tried to cut in when he was saying something, pull out when we thought he was just doing the redundant stuff. But he was the star of the Republican primary campaign last year. He just was. And there was no one else. What were we going to cover? Jeb Bush? They just weren't saying anything. The opponent, Martin O'Malley.
He was beating all the opposition.
And he was walking away with primary after primary. He was the news. Now, I'm not sure you would have the same. Would you say the same if I gave too much attention to Barack Obama? I don't think so. Well, very hard to be nonpartisan in this business. We did the best we could. And obviously, our audience wanted to hear it. Our audience is fairly progressive. And they wanted to catch Trump. And I got to tell you, when we'd sit there with the sound, we were just watching it. Top liberal columnists sat with me, and we were paying attention closely, and we were getting Trump and what he was doing. It wasn't like news was being made, and that's why he won the election.
Central question, Mueller going to get Trump? And if he does, are there just a lot of pardons to hang out?
Boy, you've just gone through the glossary of possibilities here. I think Mueller wouldn't have taken this case with his perfect resume. Not a hair out of place. The guy is the most organized-looking person. He's taking this case because he thinks there's pay dirt there, that there is something to catch, to dig up, pull out, and expose to the American people, and probably to prosecute. And so far, he's been going about it deliberatively with Manafort, with Flynn, with Rick Gates, Manafort's assistant. He's probably going to move on to Jared at some point. I'm just speculating. He's going to move up the tree of power till he gets to the president. And he will have everyone there pressured to tell the truth, with the threat against them of long imprisonment for crimes they've committed along the way. Secondly, the mandate for the special counsel is not just the Russian connection. It's any matters that arose during this investigation or do arise during the investigation. It's a wide mandate, just like the one that went after Bill Clinton when they were able to jump from Whitewater, which was nothing, to Paula Jones, which was something, to Monica, which was something. So it can daisy chain us from one to the other. I think the guy's not going to quit for a couple of years, and I think he's going to get a lot of criminal behavior established. So will he bring down this president? I think he's going to show that there was a lot of back and forth collusion between the Trump people and the Russians, like we've never seen before. I've never seen so much Russian activity in American politics. And then I think the question will be, if he does present a paper, and maybe a RICO charge, a criminal activity, an enterprise, the whole thing was working. I keep thinking what he's trying to show is this whole group of Trump people, Carter, Page, the whole bunch of them, were all involved in sort of a criminal interest in money as well as the election campaign, that there was something there that had to do with money and making
and laundering it.
Yeah, and getting something out of it, which would be a RICO charge. I mean, you could just say this whole thing's a criminal enterprise, and at the top of it all is the president. Now, you take that charge to the House Judiciary Committee, which next year will certainly be Republican. Will they act on it? I'm not sure. I think the Republican Party is still pretty intractable in terms of that. They may just stand up against him and say, no, we're not going to act. And I'm not a big fan of Paul Ryan. He won't either, the speaker. I think we might have a real constitutional problem where the
With the exception of people like McCain, Corker, and Flake, they're
good.
All in line pretty much with
that
Trump
exception.
Now.
McCain will end up being, you know, I've always had a, you're talking about being a sentimentalist. I've got a sentiment for John McCain, for what he did,
that.
What he suffered for our country. And I know
but
he
Trump
has
said he was a loser, right? Because he was a prisoner of war. Trump who?
Yeah, Trump. Yeah, when was the time? I forgot. When was the time Trump flew his jet fighter down into the enemy capital and was shot down and beaten up by the people in the water?
You don't remember that?
I don't remember that one. I mean, I think this is hard to speculate. Except I'm operating on the assumption that Mr. Mueller is a pro. And the one true thing I'm confident of, if there's any dirt there, any criminality involving anything dirt under the fingernails of Trump and his people, we will know it. I am absolutely confident that Mueller will not let anything get past him.
We got seconds left. A lot of people want to know, is there another Bobby Kennedy? Is there someone who can fill those shoes? Anybody in the works?
I don't know. I just want to say this, that the Democratic Party has done a pretty good job of discarding the white working class. It began under Reagan. It began all kinds of reasons. It goes back to Archie Bunker and the whole condescension thing. I do think they've got to make an effort to bring those people back into the party. And whoever does that deserves the nomination.
Chris Matthews, and the author of the new book on Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. Good to have you. Thanks for joining us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.